Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. It's Ed Fallon, folks. I'm your host. We're coming to you from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, underwriting provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan, local, and global foods, and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Our program's bumper music is provided by the Des Moines Irish Session. Now, before we talk about cockroaches and politics, I've got two other things stuck in my craw. The court ruling on the National Mall Reflecting Pool and Bears Ears National Monument. One of these is going well. The other, well, we'll see. It's still not good right now, but still too early to tell. And we'll start with the bad news first. Get that out of the way, right? Okay, so it's no surprise, no secret that Donald Trump is no fan of our national parks, but he's a big fan of the extraction industries, whether those be oil, gas, coal, or rare earth minerals. So Bears Ears was, first of all, I've never been there, but I understand Bears Ears is called that. There's these two twin buttes, hills, we call them here in the Midwest. Mesa-like. I guess a butte is somewhat different than a mesa, but these are unique because they look like a bear's head, all right? Great name. The area is sacred to several Native American tribes. There's been a lot of study done out there, and this has astounded me. There are over 100,000 ancient archaeological sites on this 1.5 million acre region. 100,000, crazy. This went back to 2016, before Trump took office. Obama designated this area as a national monument. And that marks, some say, the first time that five tribes, in this case, I think, got together, united to petition the government to make this. And they've been working on that for decades. They finally got it done under Obama, as Obama was leaving the White House. So yeah, there was the Hopi Nation, the Navajo, the Ute Indian tribe, the Ute Mountain tribe, and then the Zuni. They all consider that land an unbroken living home, and they're connected to their ancestors through it. And they, again, they've been pushing for decades to protect that site. So what does Trump do? Well, of course, I think part of it is he doesn't like Native Americans. Part of it is he really doesn't like Obama. And if Obama accomplished something that he can unaccomplish, he'll do it, right? And also there's uranium, vanadium, copper, silver. It's silver that's there, and zinc, a whole bunch of really important minerals. And Trump says, and others in the industry say, that they're really important to national security and energy independence. And there's probably some truth to that. Independent surveys by the state of Utah itself and by other entities, geological surveys, say, yeah, these things are here, but they classify the amalgamation of these minerals as low to moderate in terms of their potential for development. So, again, I think a big part of this is Trump's tour of vengeance, Obama now getting it, and Native Americans getting it. So the tribes, they use this region for sacred ceremonies. They gather medicinal plants there. They sometimes collect firewood. There are all kinds of cliff dwellings, granaries, artifacts dating back literally thousands of years. And there are these ancient petroglyphs and pictographs on some of the canyon walls. And it's, again, very, very sacred to five different Native communities. And they did not see this coming. They claimed to have had zero consultation with the Trump administration. And Trump's order eliminates 90% of Bear's Ears. Again, this is not the only national monument, not the only park that he's come after. 90% of Bear's Ears being eliminated. Former Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, she's from the Laguna Pueblo, and I met her during the Great March for Climate Action. We went through New Mexico. She criticized the administration's handling of the sacred ancestral homelands and just said, you're basically just giving it over to corporate interests, to mining interests. So, and Trump's claim was that, quote, the reduction will better align the use of these public lands with the public interest. So he claims the public interest is being represented because the majority of the Utah members of Congress are supportive. And the majority of them are, of course, Republicans and pretty compliant with the Trump agenda. Yet a Utah State University poll, several polls actually, in 2024, 25, found that 53% of Utah residents support, and many strongly support, preserving Bear's Ears as a national monument. Compare that with 26% who wanted to see, you know, done to it what Trump did, and 21% had no opinion. So again, a fourth of the population of Utah supports what Trump did. Nationwide, it's even worse. 87% of Republicans support preserving Bear's Ears. 92% of independents, 96% of Democrats. Even the share of MAGA supporters who wanted to keep the existing national monument the way it is, it was 81% in 2025, up to 87% now this year. So Trump, you know, again, lying again. And why? To aid his big business buddies and to take another stab at Obama and to, you know, to get back at Native Americans who have overwhelmingly oppose his administration. That's stuck in my craw. Again, it's not good right now, but where it's going to go, I cannot imagine, given the public pressure and public sentiment on this, that Trump's designation of, again, downsizing this area by 90% is going to stand. We'll see. So the other thing I got to say a little bit about is the reflecting pool. I've tried to avoid talking about the reflecting pool. You know, when we talk about water quality here in Iowa, we focus on things we actually drink or use for irrigation, not a decorative pond of algae in front of the Washington Monument. But this is big news. So Trump's appointee as District of Columbia Justice, Jeanine Pirro, and again, her former qualification, Fox News host. So we have not expected much from Ms. Pirro. But last week, she moved to dismiss the charges against a guy named David Hearn. David Hearn was a former Olympic canoeist from Maryland, and he had visited the reflecting pool as the construction was happening. And Trump blamed him for the damage. And Trump and the Department of Justice asked Pirro to charge Hearn with destruction of property and vandalizing the reflecting pool, which she obediently did. Again, Trump had blamed vandals, and this was, Hearn was the target. David Hearn was the target. Well, this is really interesting. After getting more information about what happened, Pirro dismissed the charges. And again, this is one of Trump's appointees. Remember, this is one of his people he put in charge of justice in Washington, D.C., and she said that her office would not have sought charges if the Interior Department, who manages the site, had initially shared more information about repair work on the reflecting pool. So I'm going to read you a few of the quotes from her ruling. The department only recently disclosed findings that Pirro said, quote, strongly suggests that a rushed and botched installation by the company led to the damage to the lining of the reflective pool. So that was not known to Pirro or the prosecutors or the grand jury at the time that she was asked to take action. And this all, I'll read you another quote. She says her office, quote, reached out to the Department of Interior dozens and dozens of times. And that the DOI slowly started trickling information in. And had the department been forthcoming with the information, you know, clearly in its possession, the government would not have sought a grand jury indictment. So Pirro goes on to say, specifically, the newly released documents reveal that work on installing the lining almost immediately fell behind due to a testing on the sealing of the expansion joints, the delays in obtaining sealing product at the work site. So the rush to complete the project led to hasty and botched work that was not remediated before the project was finished and the fencing removed. Pirro said that, quote, almost immediately after work was initially completed, peeling was observed along the pool perimeter. So, I mean, the evidence is so overwhelming that this was bad workmanship, that it was not vandalism. You know, again, the problem is Trump cannot admit that he was wrong. He cannot admit that he screwed up, that he rushed a job that probably never needed to happen in the first place, that he hired a buddy, a friend, a corporation that sucks up to him. He hired them to do the work. They did a lousy job. So instead of accepting that fact, he's got to blame somebody. He's got to blame, quote, vandals, or in this case, one particular vandal, an Olympic canoeist. David Hearn's lawyers said, quote, the government's dismissal today does not erase the abuse of government power in arresting and charging a patriotic American who did nothing wrong. The government's approach was ready, fire, aim. The administration owes Mr. Hearn an apology, end quote. I would suggest further they owe him damages. It's appalling that they would do this and get away with it. And well, they did not get away with it. And despite having your preferred person in charge in Washington, D.C., in the Justice Department, you did not get away with it, Mr. Trump, because the evidence was so overwhelming that your own appointee had no option but to say, hey, this is not right. We got to drop this case. This guy is not guilty. It is clear, crystal clear, that this is poor workmanship. So you would think Trump, if he was a decent guy, would say, oh, yeah, I screwed up on that. Sorry about that. But no, of course not. You silly you. Trump didn't say that. So he posted on social media over the weekend, quote, I disagree 100% with Jeanine Pirro. And then he was still, you know, just mad as heck days later. And I'm not sure what event this was at, but he insisted, he went on for minutes, several minutes, insisting that vandalism was what had marred the project. And he says, quote, I was disappointed with Jeanine Pirro, really disappointed. She folded like an umbrella, which I got to admit is a kind of a cute metaphor, especially when you're talking about water. Bottom line is he's probably going to fire her. He's probably going to fire her and appoint a lackey that he can count on. Yeah. He has apparently, you know, discussed this with his aides. And I'm almost certain when you don't do what the leader wants, you get ousted. But what it means is this. Trump is losing. He's losing key battles, and this is a battle that never should have been fought in the first place. I mean, there was nothing wrong with the reflecting pool. He wanted a different shade of blue underneath. And he rushed the whole thing through at more cost than he originally said it would take, with a company that was not equipped to do it. The company rushed to try to get to that July 4th deadline, and as a result, we have a shoddy job, a waste of taxpayer money. This is a battle, like the war in Iran, that never should have been waged. And, you know, Trump is basically, he's losing these battles, and he is losing a grip on his lackeys. Sorry, Jeanine Pirro. I mean, you were appointed because Trump thought you would do everything he wanted you to do. You didn't. Good for you. Good for you. But again, looking at the evidence, you had no choice. This was something that you absolutely had to. There was no other position to come down to. None. This was absolutely certain a question of poor workmanship. And, you know, if the administration had shared that information with you the first time, instead of Pirro, she had, in her own words, dozens and dozens of times her staff had to request the information. And clearly, you know, Trump's other lackeys did not want to release that because, if we release this, then the whole argument that this was vandalism goes away. And that's what happened. There's good news here. Good news that somebody that Trump thought he could count on actually, followed the course of reason and truth and ruled correctly. And we'll see what happens with Bear's ears. I'm not convinced that's done yet. It's right now, it's horrible. 90% of that national monument, critically important to many Native American tribes, 90% of it vanquished with the stroke of a pen. Against public opinion, again, the vast majority of Americans did not want that to happen. We'll see. I don't think it's a done deal yet. But I do know what's done, and that's this segment. I got to take a short break, folks. I went on longer than I thought I would about that, but that happens when I get something stuck in my craw, as we say. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about these cockroaches and politics and what's going on in India and how that's relevant to what's going on here. Back in a minute, and a reminder that underwriting for this program is provided by Dr. David Drake, a psychiatrist serving patients in Iowa and Colorado. More information at 515-229-5085.
Thanks to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks, broadcasting from the dead center of the U.S., Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, underwriting for the Fallon Forum provided by real estate agent Joe Henry. More information at 515-208-7312. There has been a huge movement in India, and maybe you've been following it. It's over invalidated examination results, which is a weird thing. I mean, when I hear that, I don't know what to think about examination results. How can that lead to a movement? Anyway, I'll talk more about it as time allows later, but the opera over this has resulted in students and allies of students calling for Narendra Modi's administrator of education to step down. Modi is, of course, the prime minister of India, been there a long time. In response to some of the protests, India's highest judge called the youth organizers cockroaches, you know, which is kind of what we've seen with Trump calling his opponents certain names. Authoritarians, dictators, fascists do this. They denigrate their opponents with horrible names. And one student, Abhijit Dipka, I think I'm saying his name correctly, he responded to the insult on X by saying, quote, "What if the cockroaches marched?" And that's all it took to kick off a nationwide movement. That movement led to the formation of the Cockroach Party. And a few weeks later, the Indian Minister of Education, Dharmendra Pradhan, resigned. This is a big thing, because the government of Narendra Modi has been ruling with an iron fist. They've not been held accountable. They've not had to back down. But I want to read you something from the publication Waging Nonviolence. Quote, for a movement that began online in May and grew into a nationwide agitation, forcing a cabinet minister from office was an unmistakable political concession. So again, Modi, not used to backing down, not used to losing, kind of like Trump, beginning everything his way, right? Except for the reflecting pool. Well, now the government of India has had to concede. And again, it seems like small stuff when I tell you examination results, but it's a big deal. Even though the government conceded and fired the education minister, about 100 protesters have been arrested. And despite assurances from the government, that wasn't going to happen. The demonstrators would not be punished. So the last time the Indian capital of Delhi saw a big mass movement of youth who were, again, opposing government policies, the state responded by naming the organizers in calling them conspirators. So, and two of those, quote, conspirators, Umar Khalid and Sharjil Imam, they have been held in jail, in prison, for more than 5 years. And they were again refused bail just last month. Anger against the government has been going on for a while. And yeah, this should sound familiar because, you know, like Modi, you know, Donald Trump, Stephen Miller, and others in the administration have become expert at demonizing the opposition. Last week, we talked about Stephen Miller calling protesters, quote, left-wing terrorists, and then imprisoning some with absurd sentences. I mean, sentences that will last more than their lifetime for incredibly minor offenses. And again, there were some who did some things that were, in my opinion and in most legal opinions, were deserving of punishment. But some of them were just there participating nonviolently, and yet they're getting these ridiculous sentences. So, yeah, I mean, this is what we see with authoritarians. They cannot tolerate criticism. They cannot tolerate protest. They cannot tolerate anything that implies a level of weakness. So, you know, like, as in the U.S., you know, we've got people like Stephen Miller who envision, I mean, come on, he's even said it, a white Christian nation, you know, in India. You know, Modi's party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, again, I hope I'm saying it right, that's a far right-wing Hindu party. And it has governed India since, 2014, I guess. It's been over 10 years now. The party is openly anti-Muslim. They've been able to maintain power a lot of times through fear, through oppression, and through offering some things to people that give them hope. Again, I can see that Donald Trump has tapped into this wave of populism, this distrust of government, this desire for more local control that is rampant in our country, even though he's doing the exact opposite of what people really want. He's got the language that has allowed him to achieve power. So again, same in India. And again, I'm no India expert, but from what I can see, the parallels are pretty hard to miss. So this is also from that same Waging Nonviolence story. For 5 weeks, Delhi police dealt with a protest that offered nothing conventional to target. There was no office to raid, no membership list to seize. The two things that allowed police to quell early movements were those: an office and a list, and key leaders. So on the morning of July 18th, again, just a few weeks ago, the police went for one man everyone knew, a fellow named Sonam Wangchuk. He's an engineer, he's an educator, education reformer, I should say. He's from the northern part of the country, the Himalayas. He's 59, and he was 20 days into a hunger strike. He'd lost more than 18 pounds. Police came to the site of his protest in Delhi and removed him and took him to a hospital. Wangchuk has now become the most recognizable face in a movement that insisted it had no leader. He didn't, kind of accidental leadership. And after he was taken away, I think, and I remember seeing this in, the one thing about India I do know a good bit about is the work of Mahatma Gandhi. The English authorities at the time thought that if they remove Gandhi, then, you know, they'll be able to kind of squelch the movement. Well, here they removed Wang Chuck, and instead of the movement going away, because he really wasn't the leader of it, more protesters than ever came to this location, this square in central Delhi. The square is just a half mile from India's parliament. And it's the only place in Delhi, interestingly, where a demonstration is permitted at all. And again, we see that in this country. This is not just under Republican presidents, but under Democratic presidents, too. The free speech zones, the area where you're allowed to protest, usually somewhat removed from the location of the event you're protesting. So, and I don't know the geography of Delhi very well, but apparently the central place near India's parliament is where protests are allowed to occur. And so for 5 weeks, that became a tent city of students, parents who had spent their life savings on high-stakes test coaching, teachers, lawyers, a few farmers' unions, and a great many people in their 20s who had never protested before. Okay, so a little more background on this examination situation. So every year there's about 2 million Indian teenagers. They take what's called the National Eligibility Entrance Test. They're hoping to be one of 130,000 that are granted undergraduate admission to a medical college. Again, 130,000 out of 2 million. That's a tough one. So towns, entire villages get together to coach kids for the exam. And the exam happens in May. And this year, 9 days after the exam, the government canceled the results over an alleged paper leak and told 2 million candidates to take it a second time. This is so, I mean, there is such intensity leading up to this that students died by suicide in the weeks that followed. And I don't know if there was any, I don't know the detail about the alleged leaks, but my guess is that it was bogus. I haven't dug that deep into this, but the exam itself is so intense, so much preparation, so much money spent on coaching the kid from your village you hope will go on to be a doctor, that it literally was, it was devastating. It was devastating financially to families. It was devastating emotionally and physically to students, to the point where several committed suicide. Basically, whenever there was a protest in Delhi at this place where protests were allowed, it only got taken seriously if the mainstream TV crews showed up. And so the people, the cockroaches, the people involved in the cockroach party, they decided that they would just film it themselves. They weren't going to wait for the TV, the mainstream TV stations, to take it seriously. They took it into their own hands. They live streamed the speeches. They circulated their own footage of the police lines. And they followed up with independent reporters. The Cockroach Party called for a mile-long march to Parliament House on July 20th, again, just a couple weeks ago. That was the opening day of both monsoon season and Parliament. I don't know if those typically occur on the same day. But permission for that march was refused. And instead, the state responded by switching off mobile internet access around the site, closing metro stations, train stations, and putting up barricades. And more than 10,000 marched anyway. And a lot of that was anger over Wang Chuck, the faster's removal. The placards, according to those who have reported on this, have stopped asking politely. One carried Education Minister Dharmendra Pradhan's photograph with the word resign across it. Since you are a government servant, you work for us, we pay your salary, we, the people of India, fire you. There are balloons tied together to the same hand that read grow a pair. I commend Indians for being so adept with English. This went on and on again. There were 180 protesters injured because the police fought back. 70 were detained. Several videos showed police attacking marchers. None have surfaced showing marchers attacking the police. You know, I suspect that Mahatma Gandhi would be very impressed, would be very proud of what's going on, that he would see the thread of nonviolent action that he helped spread well over 100 years ago, you know, blossoming today in response to a tyrannical government. You know, and it's kind of sad that India, which, again, gained its independence, mostly nonviolently in response to British imperialism, has now to deal with these problems. I guess that could be said about any country, including our own. It's a shame that a country, oh, the USA, that responded to British tyranny here, now has a guy in the White House who is acting quite a bit like a tyrant. And again, I don't put the entire blame on Republicans or Donald Trump. I think both Democratic and Republican administrations have kind of paved the way for this level of consolidation within the in the administration. Anyway, so we'll see where this goes. This is fascinating to me, and I don't know. I don't think it's over. Not by a long shot. I do think we should be paying attention because I think we can learn a lot from what's happening. Again, it's nonviolent. It's disciplined, but it's also dispersed. There's not your one leader, your one you know, person that everybody goes to. And I suspect that Wang Chung, the faster, will kind of at some point fade from prominence, and others will rise to prominence for whatever reason. And I think that's a good thing for the movement. And I think, again, that they have a chance to really turn things around in India. So when the cockroach party succeeded in getting rid of the education minister, they posted four words: cockroaches won, democracy won. Hey, I got to take a short break, folks. When we come back, we'll be talking about Head Start and politics. Back in a minute, and a reminder that underwriting for this program provided by Western Optometry. More information at 515-789-3055. Thanks to our nonprofit partners, including Circle of Peacemakers. Formerly the Catholic Peace Ministry, Circle of Peacemakers works with people of all faiths toward a world without war. CPM opposes runaway military spending while domestic needs go unmet. Instead of endless wars, CPM supports diplomacy. Visit circleofpeacemakers.com. At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. This is Ed Fallon, your host. We're broadcasting from America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa, with content that should be important to you wherever you live in this country. Underwriting provided by Architecture by Synthesis. More at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, primary elections. I'm recording this program bright and early on Wednesday morning because we have a deadline. That actually was yesterday, but we can squeak that a little bit here. And wanted to just tell you a little bit about what went on in the elections this week. You probably already know, but there were, you know, three U.S. Senate seats up, primaries that is, and 46 U.S. House seats. So, of course, the highest profile race, the Democratic Senate primary in Michigan, where at this moment, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, He's a public health officer and used to work with the Obama administration. Versus U.S. Congresswoman Haley Stevens. They've been in a tight race, very tight, because as of this morning, it's still too close to call officially. Although, come on, I mean, with over 1.5 million votes cast, El-Sayed has got a 1 percentage point lead with 96% of the vote counted. So that's pretty much a win. It's a big deal. I mean, it shows that the more Democratic voters are tired of the status quo. And yeah, status quo, because Stevens was endorsed by, you know, the big name Democrats, Governor Whitmer, Chuck Schumer, or as I like to call, you know, the U.S. Senate leaders, Democratic leaders' endorsement, the kiss of death. So Chuck Schumer backing Stevens, I mean, his track record here in Iowa is absolutely terrible, and I presume it's not much better around the country. But the big D's got beat by a guy who was endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America and Bernie Sanders. Although he says he's not a socialist, he just believes that capitalism has to be regulated. Yeah, all right, fair enough. Also in Michigan, another very interesting race, a fellow named William Lawrence. He's the co-founder of the Sunrise Movement. That's the youth-led climate movement that has made a lot of noise until recently. I haven't heard much of them in the last few years. Maybe I'm just missing out on that, but they certainly garnered a lot of attention around the Green New Deal. He won the Democratic primary in Michigan's 7th congressional district. I believe that's a swing district. I'm not quite sure. But he beat two prominent Democrats. Maybe they divided the vote. We'll see how that shapes up in the fall. So another big race in Missouri. Representative Cori Bush lost her rematch. She had been beaten by Wesley Bell a couple years ago. And a lot of her platform has been opposition to Israel's genocide in Gaza. AIPAC, the American-Israeli, it's not political action committee, but basically the PAC that the Israeli government and its Zionist supporters fund put a lot of money into beating her last time. But AIPAC this year has been losing races left and right. I've shared my own AIPAC story with you before. Not pretty. And they between AIPAC, Bell's own contributions to his campaign and other outside groups, I'm assuming that the U.S. House leadership, the Democratic leadership in the U.S. House, also supported Bell. Well, they outspent Cori Bush 27-1. I mean, that's like getting run over by a herd of bulldozers. I mean, it's hard to see any candidate having a chance against those kind of numbers. Anyway, she did lose. Kudos for taking another shot at it, because again, I think a lot of this had to do with that big money coming in. So I always respect and admire candidates, wherever they are on the political spectrum, who try to run low-budget campaigns. Okay, in Washington State, there was Maria Glusenkamp Perez. She's a maverick of sorts, for sure. She does not fit in well with many within the Democratic Party. But she's done well. She's won in the Republican district. I think it might even be the most Republican House district in the U.S. So she doesn't really fall into the two camps that the mainstream media like to talk about. And she won her primary. It was a very narrow victory. And it's one of those primaries, like we also have seen in California, where it's an open primary. The top two vote-getters, regardless of party affiliation, move on to the general election. So she and the lead Republican finished within, like, I think a percentage point or two. They will face off in the general. And so that's good news for her, because most of the other votes went to another Democrat. So who knows what'll happen. But anyway, she's an intriguing candidate because she focuses on things like being able to fix your own, you know, your own vehicles, your own tools. She owns an auto repair shop. She talks about I think the expression was the plague of bright headlights. I can relate to that. Headlights have definitely gotten brighter, more obnoxious, more difficult to navigate at night. And she's trying to do something about it. Good for her. She's got some other issues that all of us, probably most of us listening, would probably disagree with. But anyway, it'll be an interesting election that this fall between her and her Republican opponent. But I want to take issue with the mainstream media. I mean, NPR, CNN, The New York Times, you name it. They like to talk about, quote, moderate Democrats, centrist Democrats. And that's always juxtaposed against progressive Democrats. And I get so tired of these labels. I mean, come on. Have we not had enough? What does moderate even mean? Moderate in what way? What does centrist mean? What are you central to? Are you between two extremes? Are you between two different visions? Are you between a corporate agenda and a populist agenda? I mean, I think Paul Wellstone, the U.S. Senator from Minnesota who died tragically in an airplane crash years ago and was in some ways my political mentor, I think Paul Wellstone nailed it when he said, yeah, I'm a centrist. I'm fighting for issues that are central to the lives of my constituents. That sums it up. But that's not what the media means by it. The media means by it, basically, it's a compliment to be called moderate or centrist by the New York Times or NPR. And if you're progressive, then you're out there a bit too far. If you're conservative, you're probably okay, but maybe not quite out there as far as progressive, but you're still, tagged. And I happen to think that conservative is a legitimate label when it comes to financial stuff. When you are conservative when it comes to money, you are hesitant to overspend. I was a conservative. When it came to fiscal matters, I was absolutely conservative as a state lawmaker. I have a voting record to prove it. That didn't stop me from getting labeled as extreme liberal. And, to me, liberal literally means generous, okay with spending to help people. I mean, to me, that's what a classic liberal is. I look at it in economic terms. Beyond that, you get all mixed up when you start considering conservatives as somebody who is against marriage equality or is against abortion rights. I think the best way to look at those kind of issues is through the lens of a libertarian. Do you want government involved in these decisions or not? If you get those publications, challenge their use of the words moderate and centrist, because I think what it really is code for friendly toward corporate interests. That's really what they mean by it. They don't mean what Paul Wellstone meant by centrist. They don't mean central, concerned about the centrist is concerned about the issues central to the lives of their constituents. They don't mean that at all. They mean something relevant to how friendly you are toward corporate interests. I think do away with those terms, challenge them. And, and the truth is, let me take Maria Gleason-Camp-Perez. She's all over the board on stuff, And most people are. Whether you're in politics or just paying attention, you're probably all over the board on stuff. There's probably not a convenient label that fits you. I got tagged as being very, very liberal, and I think it was because I was defending things like marriage equality and abortion rights. Funny, I think every libertarian's credentials collapse on one issue, and it varies from libertarian person to one to another. For me, it was gambling. I hated gambling. I hated to see an industry continue to expand, putting other small businesses out of business and basically preying on, in a lot of cases, senior citizens. So the only exception I made is I was happy to see that the Native American tribes in my state were capitalizing on gambling and finding a way to build a financial base that had been denied to them for a long time. Anyway, so my bottom line is these tags don't work real well. Again, I was called very liberal as a state lawmaker. My voting record on fiscal matters, very conservative. Conservative, again, literally meaning I was hesitant to spend a lot of money. I voted against most budget bills. Sometimes I voted against them because of content. Oftentimes I voted against them because of the amount of money being spent or the oversight being provided. So we got to do away with these labels. They are really ridiculous. And they need to be challenged, especially moderate. What does moderate mean? What does it mean? Moderation in all things. Or was it Ben Franklin to coin that expression? As he really should have said, moderation in nearly all things, right? I want to move on to a couple other things before we wrap up this program. Head Start. Okay, Trump is trying to basically gut Head Start by radically changing the criteria for the program. It's been around since the 1960s. For those who don't know, Head Start is an early education program for poor kids. Families earning less than $33,000 a year, families of four, that is. The program has been struggling. The funding has often been, had a hard time keeping pace with inflation and increased costs. And it's led some Head Start centers have had to trim back on services, trim back on the number of people that can serve. The bottom line is Head Start has been praised by experts and parents alike. And I'm one of those parents. My kids went to Head Start. We were, and back then, when in the 1980s, I think the income threshold was less than $20,000 a year. Anyway, so it was a great program. And my daughter ended up going, it's supposed to be a one-year program, but if you're caught in a certain age range, you sometimes get in for 2 years, and my daughter did, and my son went for a year. It was a great experience. They got all kinds of help, and it freed us up to accomplish our low-paid work, working goals, musician and activist. but we were doing good work, and we spent most of the time was with our kids, but during the day, for some hours, they'd go to Head Start, and it was a great experience. Great experience. I can't say enough about it, and I really hope that people are pushing back against the efforts to basically downgrade it to make it more difficult for people to be able to enroll their kids. So the one other thing I want to talk about before we wrap up this program is climate migration. There are places around the country that are already experiencing refugees from climate disasters. We certainly know about what happened in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina. And like most parts of the country, Des Moines has seen people move here from New Orleans after that disaster. But some are estimating that by the end of the century, as many as 13 million Americans could have moved inland from coastal areas because of sea level rise. Now, that's been some quality research, but I'm going to go out on a limb, and I've said this before. Iowa's population is a little over 3 million. I can envision our population rising to 30 million. I mean, that's huge, but when you've got places with good soil, adequate rainfall, no chance of wildfires devastating our landscape, no chance we have plenty of flood risks along the rivers. But it's not the same as sea level rise. I think we've talked about before concerns that the Colorado River is drying up, that Lake Mead is never going to be able to meet the water needs of the Southwest, and conversations about trying to divert the Great Lakes to the Southwest, which are insane. That is an insane proposal. Iowa is not a Great Lakes state. We're one state removed, but every Great Lakes state, I think all eight of them are adamantly opposed to that. We've got to take this seriously, folks. We have to begin to think about where and how people are going to move and how we're going to accommodate that. Hey, underwriting for this program provided by Dr. Kim Holding with Story County Veterinary Clinic, serving Story County pets for over 30 years. More information at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. We'll be back in a minute, folks. Kathy Burns is going to join me. We're going to be taking your garden, well, not your, but garden Q&A questions we've been getting for the past few days, and hopefully you'll find some value in that. Back in a minute with you, Ed Fallon here on the Fallon Forum. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Underwriting for this program provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan local and global foods, and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program.
It's time for garden Q&A because it's the beginning of August, yeah.
Right, and people don't think much about planting in August, but those are silly people.
Some people seem surprised when they find out we don't just take the garden out after the summer harvest or in the middle of the summer harvest almost. But, you know, I go through some social media groups to look at gardening questions, and we get this every year.
Yeah, and here's the typical one. I didn't put a garden this year, but would like to plant some things now. Any suggestions for fall harvesting, or am I too late? I have a cold frame. I can plant kale and Swiss chard in there, right? Would any flowers bloom before frost?
You want to handle the kale and chard in the cold frame question first?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't plant kale and Swiss chard now.
I wouldn't do that. Actually, a cold frame you wouldn't start using until October.
Well, again, we're in the upper Midwest here.
Yes, true.
October. But, you know, I mean, kale and Swiss chard, I guess you could plant them now. We've never done that.
I hope the person who wrote this question is listening and will let us know how it goes. but as far as what can you plant, what can't you plant? Well there's a lot that you can't plant. We just talked about maybe one of them, but we're just full of ideas about that. Golly, we're putting in carrots. I'm trying some fall peas for the first time this year. We'll see how that goes.
Beans?
Green beans and
dried beans too.
Some more dried beans. We do a lot of black beans and pinto beans. And what else are we putting in?
Turnips? Tons of turnips. Because turnips are not only good for eating, they're good for soil.
They're good for the soil. We're doing some cover crop. So we're doing some fall planting of a mixture of turnip and red wheat?
Yeah. Winter wheat, yeah.
Winter wheat seed. So we need to replenish our soil a little bit, give it a rest, and if it doesn't have to produce a lot of, you know, big foods, it can get re-nourished a little bit.
But I mean, I guess in our area, early August is a good time to plant fall stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would wait a little bit later maybe for lettuce, maybe second week of August for lettuce, spinach, arugula.
It's been so hot here.
But go for it, yeah.
Keep everything watered.
Let your planting whims run crazy.
Yeah. That'll be fun. It's all about the growing season for that particular crop. If it can come to fruition before the first frost, you're good to go.
Somebody writes, I have a million tomatoes on my plants, but none of them are turning red. I've taken two off so far that were partial. And then my cherry tomatoes, I have picked several orange ones. Any help as to why they aren't changing colors?
I'm going to guess that the tomatoes are determinate, or probably a hybrid tomato, not indeterminate, or probably an heirloom tomato. The determinant will come on all at once. There's a determined time for it. It's a determined season for it. They kind of come on all at the same time or in the same week or two, and you got to pick them all. They take a little longer to come on, but indeterminate varieties, heirloom varieties, will start earlier, ripen earlier, and then the season will last longer. They just keep growing and growing.
Yeah, if they have, quote, a million, I'm not making that up, that's what they say, tomatoes, but they're not turning red. They're probably all just getting ready for that moment when they're determined, predetermined turn red.
Well, and if they're blushing, yes, you can pick them when they're blushing. We discussed this a couple of weeks ago, and they will ripen on your counter. You don't have to do anything special to them, and they'll be just fine. In fact, it can help the plant produce more tomatoes for you.
So somebody writes that they're looking at a photograph of a shallow fountain. It's on Etsy. It's called a bee-themed gift from a company in England. They say, really cool water feature for the bees. Wish I had a place in the room.
Well, the bees do want a lot of water in this heat. We've had a lot of neighbors say, your bees are all over my bird feeder right now.
Bird
bath right now. And it could be anybody's bees, frankly.
Sure.
But yes, bees need to get their water, and they've been struggling to get enough lately. But you don't need to buy a fancy contraption.
No, the problem with a bird bath is the water tends to be deep enough for birds to bathe in, thus the name. but it's also deep enough for bees to drown in. Mm-hmm. And they will drown. You will see the little bodies.
Their backstroke wears out.
Backstroking their way into oblivion, you know?
Yeah.
But when we did have a bird feeder that we used for water, we would put a rock in there so that they could sit on the rock and drink without drowning.
Kind of a flat, sloping rock. Think in terms of a kiddie pool, where you have a graduated entrance point for the children.
And bees will suck water out of the dirt. So if you've got an area around the hives that has a good soaking every morning or something, that should do it too.
Mm-hmm. Or if you want to help your neighbor's bees or the wild bees, you know, put a little dish of some kind out that's not too deep, and you know, let the bees have some water. They can make better honey if they don't have to go too far for water.
Right. Okay. Somebody asked, where does everyone source their garlic for fall planting? Well, we're way ahead of that. That's not till October, November.
Mm-hmm. We're way ahead of planting time.
Yeah, I guess it's the right time to source your heads.
It certainly is. I know some of the seed companies have it. A lot of the farm stores will have it. The farm and feed stores. But it, you know, you solve the problem before next year by saving some of next year's harvest for your fall planting.
Because the garlic that we have now, I got it in 2015, and we're using the same stash. This is this will be 12 years running now.
Yeah, and so we don't have time to go into how you save it, but look that up. But we just want to make sure that we're talking about Iowa, so people have better luck with the hardneck variety of garlic. So it's winter garlic.
We plant it early November.
We do.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Kathy.
You bet.
And thanks to our production team of Sherry Hardina, Forrest Dennerman, Charles Goldman, Kathy Burns, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to the Des Moines Iver Session for our bumper music. Underwriting provided by Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and Real Estate Agent Joe Henry. Also, Circle of Peacemakers, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. This is Ed Fallon, folks, your host for the Fallon Forum. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.